All right, Dr. Raskas, thank you for joining us on the episode today.
So happy to be here, and it seems like you've had an illustrious set of guests, so I'm honored to be included.
No, absolutely, absolutely. So tell us a little bit about your background. How did you first get into medicine? You are a doctor, right?
Correct, yeah, I'm pediatric emergency trained, and I always had a passion for STEM, you know, science and math, but really wanted to do something a little bit more on my feet, interacting with people, and medicine just ended up being like a perfect fit. There wasn't one aha moment, but in undergraduate, loved the sciences, but wanted to be able to work with people. I've spent my entire life, including now, almost every summer working or being a camper at a summer camp. And so just a lot of experience with kids and working with other people in that context. And so pediatrics was a natural fit.
Awesome. Great. And how long did you spend in the clinic? Or how long have you spent in the clinic?
So I did 10 years of training. So 4 years of medical school, three years of pediatric residency, 3 years of a pediatric emergency fellowship. And then I've worked for the past 6 years at PM Pediatric Care, which is a pediatric urgent care, now also doing pediatric mental health and school telemedicine.
Gotcha. And not to give too much weight to the listener, but you were also involved with informatics and stuff. And how did the informatics side enter the picture? And how much of your time do you spend seeing patients versus working on the informatics side of the equation?
So right around the time of the High Tech Act, I was in medical school at Harvard, and there was a student and faculty small group that got together that said, oh, there are these mobile devices coming out. Let's figure out how those are going to interplay with medicine and what are the benefits going to be. And so there was actually a mobile device group, and they actually sponsored us each to get some Palm device or a BlackBerry and try and figure out how we could, you know, use medical knowledge on those devices together with rounding on patients. And so that was really my first foray into informatics. And then immediately after finishing medical school, when I was doing my pediatric residency at Texas Children's in Houston, they were in the midst of converting from paper-based charting to Epic. And so it was a massive conversion to an EHR for a hospital, and I became the liaison to all the trainees at the hospital. It was a very large training facility, and so there were 170 residents and fellows at the hospital, and I got very involved with the EHR committee then at that time.
Gotcha. So it's really just kind of thrown in the water, like sink or swim, right? And, and you figure it out. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And so as part of your job now, describe what you do. 100% of your time is split between different things. Let's talk about what you do as part of your day job.
Yeah. So I usually say I have two or three full-time jobs, and they just all kind of blend together. One hat is I see patients. So one day a week, mostly in the office, but also on telemedicine, I'll see patients. And that's pediatric urgent care patients. We're often an alternative to a pediatric emergency department. So we'll see, you know, pediatric patients up to age 26 for common things that people would go to a doctor's office. So sore throat, ear infections, lots of COVID in the last several years. But then we also deal with more complex situations like significant breathing issues and respiratory distress, lacerations and large cuts that need stitches, broken bones that need x-rays and splints and things like that. So a whole range of things. So that's on the clinical side. The other job, and this is certainly a full-time one, is helping to run a team of clinical informatic leaders in our company. And so we run the electronic health record and any associated clinical software. So we work closely with our IT team who manage the hardware and the other technology, but we focus on any software that's clinical. So primarily the electronic health record, but also the telemedicine system, some other knowledge-based systems, some dictation systems, x-ray systems. And so that's another job. And then the third one is running the clinical delivery of telemedicine. Mm-hmm. So we had started telemedicine really from the day that I started working at PM. I was hired as a director of telemedicine 6 years ago, which I often mention is a very forward-looking move on the behalf of the CEOs of our company that, you know, six, 7 years ago, they were looking to hire a director of telemedicine, whereas most, you know, healthcare organizations weren't even thinking about telemedicine, let alone hiring someone specifically to grow and lead that area. And so we've been doing telemedicine since then. And of course, like many healthcare organizations, once COVID came around, our numbers, you know, skyrocketed. And so I manage the delivery of telemedicine, urgent care throughout the company.
Gotcha. So you were there pre-COVID. What was telemedicine like pre-COVID, and what were the things you guys were focused on?
Yeah. So we are, you know, essentially a national company where we have offices, physical offices in 15 states. We're up to 78 offices in those 15 states plus DC. And those offices, we certainly have a chunk on the Eastern Seaboard. I live in Maryland, and so we have from Virginia, Maryland, all the way up to Massachusetts with New Jersey, New York in between. But then we also have offices in areas like Texas and Illinois and Tennessee, and now we have California and Alaska as well. And so we did a number of initiatives and kind of pilots with telemedicine, but kind of refocused our efforts about 3-4 years ago, again, about a year before COVID, and decided to launch our telemedicine in a direct-to-consumer fashion where people at home could, you know, call us up for a video visit where a physician or a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant would examine the child at home and provide recommendations, typically able to keep the child at home. And in a small number of cases, those children needed in-person visits either with us or elsewhere. And we started that in Alaska because the need in Alaska is clear. The story in Alaska is so clear. You know, I still remember one of the patients I saw from 3 years ago was a child who had asthma, who had pretty significant respiratory distress, but they were in a location that was a 16-hour car ride from our office in one of the major cities in Alaska. And they didn't have any other significant, you know, healthcare organizations anywhere nearby. And they were really remote. And we were talking about ways to manage things in the home that, you know, I typically would not manage at home. But again, we have to deal with kind of the circumstances, you know, at bay. And so that's obviously a very, you know, a range of experiences that you can have on telemedicine where you've got these people that are in extremely remote areas. And then we have people who call us from down the block from our offices because of the convenience and the timing and what they can do. And so we've got everything in between these urban environments and, you know, really remote patients in very different situations. And of course, how we address those situations clinically depends on the resources that they have available.
Right, right. And so you guys were forward thinking, and you put these direct-to-consumer, this direct-to-consumer infrastructure out pre-COVID. Yes. What was it like pre-COVID to try to get patients and providers on board with using telemedicine?
Yeah. In general, it was kind of like trudging through, you know, quicksand. You know, you would, you would make, you know, a huge amount of effort for a small amount of movement. You know, the providers were reluctant, the patients were confused, were reluctant, they had technology issues, bandwidth issues, and it was just a huge culture change. And even those at home who would talk about how much they love telemedicine, I'll share a story. So before, even before this, you know, sort of effort in Alaska, what we had done is we had distributed for free peripheral devices to 250 patients in the New York area and said, you know, for 5 hours every evening, we are available. Anytime your child has a medical issue, use this device, which has an otoscope and a stethoscope, and you can measure temperature and heart rate, and it was great. The device was fantastic, and we were giving all of the medical care for free. And we said to these people, just call us. You know, we will take care of your children for free, absolutely no cost. They're not being billed, insurance not being billed. We just wanted to understand what the usage was, what the, you know, viability of this was, and we were kind of doing our own research into this avenue of medical care. We could not get people, again, this was before COVID, but we could get people to call us. And we even found people had come into our offices and we said we would take care of you for free at home and you've got this device. Why don't you try? And they're like, well, I just figured someone would have to do this and do that and I didn't want to spend the time at home. And so we just found it, you know, so difficult. And the patients were more willing than the providers, but even the patients, they would say that they wanted to do it, but when it came push to shove and you actually wanted them to have those visits from home, they would just fall into their usual pattern of coming into the offices no matter what.
And that's interesting. Fall into their usual patterns. What they know, it's what they're comfortable with. And I assume that's similar on the provider side as well. What challenges did you face with the providers at that time?
Yeah. I mean, I'll never forget one of my, I have a close friend and colleague where we have kind of a funny relationship. He was actually my research mentor in fellowship. We did research on telemedicine. Mm-hmm. We both came to work for PM together. And so he is my clinical supervisor on the in-person world. But on the telemedicine world, it goes the opposite direction where I supervise him. And so it's a very funny bilateral relationship. And so just before COVID, I was literally sitting with him in our offices, trying to onboard him to telemedicine, teach him how to do telemedicine, encourage him to pick up patients. And then very soon what happened was in the early months of COVID, like many healthcare organizations, our in-person business almost evaporated, you know, and almost overnight. And so everything was switching to telemedicine. And so then the in-person people became responsible for nudging the providers to do more telemedicine because essentially the whole business, you know, kind of got unified in a sense. Yeah. And so whereas a month prior, I was nudging him to do telemedicine, he was now coming back and saying, I know you're really busy administratively and running all these things, but I need you to actually see more visits on telemedicine. I said, you realize how funny this is that a month ago, yeah. I was trying to get you to do more telemedicine visits, and now you're telling me I need to do more. So, you know, the providers were extremely hesitant, but, yeah. you know, one way or another, COVID kind of shoved us all through the door, and we found ourselves in a new room. And, you know, I think everyone has adapted since then. But I will say, you know, what we've seen a lot, both for patients and providers, and we've seen this nationally, is if you look at the percentage of visits being done by telemedicine versus in person, you know, it peaked back in April 2020, mm-hmm. May 2020, and then it's been declining. And then there was a bump in, you know, December 21 and mm-hmm. January of 22 when Omicron hit. But then the numbers have continued to decline and sort of plateaued at much lower percentages. And it depends what type of medicine you're doing. But we're finding the patients and the providers are actually kind of maybe regressing is a strong word, but they're falling back into that usual pattern of what they were doing even before COVID for a lot of things. And I'm finding myself in the office talking to people who may have traveled very far or had, you know, huge inconvenience in their life and missing work, having to bring other children, saying, you know, for this rash, that would be a great use of telemedicine. Next time we're available, just reach out to us on telemedicine and you don't have to bring your child here in person.
So what do you think is causing that regression back to the old, more painful way of providing care?
You know, it's certainly multifactorial. And obviously, if you look at different areas of medicine, it's going to be different. So I'll speak from my, you know, my experience from an urgent care side. And then I'll touch on actually our newer efforts in behavioral health, because I think it's very different over there. But on the urgent care side, I think, you know, first of all, what we found interestingly was in 2020, as things were starting to open up, people were craving some type of in-person experience. And healthcare was one of the few ways that people could have like a sanctioned in-person experience that was, you know, collectively considered okay. So like in May of 2020, people were just eager to like walk into our offices and talk to somebody. Like, this is so nice. I've been in my house for a month or two. I can talk to somebody. Now certainly that's changed and we're in a different position. So, you know, I think the reasons now are people have, again, a perception of, I may need something in person and I don't want to start the process one way and have to repeat it and expend the extra effort and cost doing it a different way. And so they come in person not knowing what could be handled at home on telemedicine. I think that's certainly part of it. And I think, you know, again, there's that sort of usual pattern of behavior. If I'm out of the house, if I'm doing errands, the perception of the world is still doctors and healthcare are seen in person, and telemedicine is relatively novel and new and different. It's not the default where people say, oh, I'm going to start in a virtual way. And only if they kind of nudge me, am I going to end up going in person.
Right.
I'd say on the behavioral health side, we've had a very different experience. So what we realized, you know, about 6 months into COVID was that we did have, you know, a large patient population that knew us well, that knew how to do telemedicine. And we started putting our heads together and saying, where are their needs and where could we bring value both to our patients and society at large? So this was 2 years ago. And we were recognizing kind of the unfortunate rise of mental health issues and knew that that was, you know, a huge need, but also extremely conducive to telemedicine. Whereas, you know, the in-person urgent care versus home, there's a lot more that people think about that needs to be done in person: blood work, x-rays, stitches, things that, you know, we're just not, there isn't an infrastructure to bring those things into the home in a scalable way at the moment. Maybe, you know, at some point there certainly are companies looking to do those things, but on the mental health side, on behavioral health, you know, it's all about the engagement and the, and the conversation. And so that can very easily be done in the home environment. And so we've done that with huge success. But again, like the falling back into usual patterns, one of the things that we're finding is some people still crave that in-person experience, which, you know, we're humans and we want to interact with each other. And even those of us who are huge supporters of, you know, video and telemedicine, we of course value that as well. And so we're actually opening up some physical offices to do behavioral health. So it's like the exact opposite story, right? We have a service line that started 100% telemedicine, and now we're adding on an in-person component as opposed to our urgent care, which started 100% in-person, you know, and then we added on the telemedicine. So I think, you know, these two stories of our different areas of clinical medicine, urgent care and behavioral health, are so interesting because they're coming at the same thing from opposite directions. And I think they'll end up, you know, both at a healthy balance in the long run where, you know, some of it will be done in-person and some of it will be done virtually. And there'll be a variety of factors that help kind of guide which, you know, cases and situations and which days and which visits will end up being one versus the other.
You know, it's interesting. You talk about before it was all in person and then you've added video and then you've come the other end where it's all video and you've started adding in person again. It seems like that. And you kind of mentioned at the end of your last comment, it's kind of going to get to a nice hybrid midpoint. What still needs to happen in order to create that ideal situation? And what is that ideal situation? Sounds like it's a hybrid, but how much? Yeah. Is it 50%? Is it 70%? Then what is still lacking to make sure it's ideal and that that future hybrid state is the most successful that it can be?
Yeah, I think, you know, thinking with my clinical informatics hat and perspective and applying it to telemedicine, what I watched happen with the electronic health records and the transition from paper to electronic documentation is there were all these specialty groups, and some of them still exist, and you and I have met at some of those conferences that talked mm-hmm. about electronic health records, and it was a niche, and it was a special way of doing things. It was a new skill set. And then essentially what's happened over the past decade is the electronic health record has just become a tool and a way to deliver healthcare. And it's not a question anymore of when do you use paper and when do you use the electronic health record. It's just sort of infused and integrated in everything that mm-hmm. we do. And I think, you know, one of the unfortunate side effects that I think happened both with electronic health records and telemedicine is they both had external stimuli that required them to be adapted in an extremely rapid mm-hmm. pace for healthcare, whereas healthcare tends to move extremely slowly. And so they both got kind of shoved in, and there's a lot of cleanup that had to be done after the fact, both with electronic health records and telemedicine, as a result of those external stimuli. The electronic health records had the HITECH Act, they had all the funding, and there right. was meaningful use criteria. And so many vendors evolved, and so many healthcare organizations adapted those systems in ways that were less than ideal because speed was the key at the time, and for understandable reasons. But similarly with telemedicine, right, in March of 2020, April of 2020, so many healthcare organizations adapted to telemedicine, but did it in ways that were, you know, very siloed and separate. And so in my mind, almost more important than what percentage and what balance we get to in the long run in different areas between telemedicine and in-person care is trying to think about how do we do continuous care, holistic care? How does it just become part and parcel of everything that we do so that it's so seamless for everybody involved? It's seamless for the patients. It's seamless for the providers. It's seamless for the payers. It's seamless for the administrators. But there's so much right now in telemedicine that's like, okay, we do it this way in telemedicine. We do it mm-hmm. this way in person. It's this system for telemedicine. It's this system for in-person. It's, I'm going to have to make a decision. Do I want the convenience of telemedicine? You know, and there's so many things that are right. different about telemedicine and in-person. And what I'm most excited about is how do we figure out how to blend that all together so that it's just high quality healthcare in a way that's convenient and affordable. And whether it's on video or whether it's a video on a peripheral device or whether it's a text message or whether it's in-person or whether it's in-person for a lab but virtual with a provider, that all these things just happen in a much more seamless way.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the biggest things that you feel need to be streamlined or simplified or made seamless on the telemedicine side of things in terms of like technology and workflows and stuff? Yeah, what's the biggest pain points using it?
Yeah, technology is always so much part of it. And I think, you know, and I'm sure you have this experience as well. So much of the time, the focus is on figuring out the technology that there's a lack of looking at the workflows or what the workflows should be ideally. And so there's sort of too much focus on the tool. So what the clinical informatics, you know, sort of mind always is thinking is let's think about what the ideal workflow is first, and let's establish that a priori, and then figure out which technologies exist that we can apply there and which technologies need to be adapted or even invented in order to close those gaps. So I think one of the things that we really need to do is take a step back and basically reimagine how we deliver healthcare, because we've got a whole new environment now compared to where we were 3 years ago. And there are things that we could do that would completely obliterate the normal workflows. You know, managing patients in a visit-to-visit way is very archaic in some ways, trying to think about more longitudinal and bigger picture ways of managing people, which aren't focused on these intermittent episodic mm-hmm. ways of caring for people. Thinking about what metrics we use to actually measure health and trying to think about what standards we want to set. And so I think both thinking about the workflows and then thinking about what are those metrics are probably two of the biggest things. And then the technology and the tools will fall into place, or the needs for new things will be far more clarified if we can do that. But so much of what we've done, again, for understandable reasons, is we've had these external stimuli that say, you know, flip your way of delivering care into a video way. And without right. thinking about the bigger picture of how do we adapt to the new capabilities of the world that we live in, which are so different than where we were 3 years ago.
Right. It's kind of like take a way that care is provided, maybe not optimally, and move it to a new environment that even it's even more unoptimal in the virtual environment, which makes things even worse. Yeah. So how do you go about it, understand that you say, you know, understand the workflow first? How do you do that at your organization? How do you really get in and understand the workflow so that you can design the right solution for that workflow?
Yeah. So, you know, I'll give you a simple example. We've had, like many healthcare organizations, particularly on our telemedicine, we have had such dramatic swings in volume where even in the past 12 months, when I look back, the difference between sort of our low points in telemedicine versus our high points in telemedicine is a tenfold difference on a daily basis. This is less than a 12-month period. And so you can imagine that creates enormous staffing challenges for us trying to predict what those volumes are going to be. And one of the things that's happened since COVID is our ability to predict and the seasonality of things is, you know, is gone. So for instance, you know, you look right now, whereas typically we don't see the volume of respiratory illnesses in October that we're seeing across the country. But if you look, you know, the hospitals are full of RSV, flu, some COVID as well. But in the pediatric world, I mean, the volume right now of what's going on from a respiratory illness is just so unheard of in the month of October. And so so the big problem that we've had is really, you know, the inability to predict and the inability realistically to sort of staff up the way we'd ideally like to. And so what we've done is, you know, we, in a very consumer and patient-centric way, trying to start from their perspective, said, okay, we're not going to be able to meet the demand. We're not going to be able to see people in an on-time way, you know, in the ideal standards that we hold ourselves to, all, you know, in a normal environment. So, but what can we do from the perspective of the patient? And so we thought about our telemedicine and we tried to figure out what ways could we communicate, especially in an automated and a scalable way with patients, where they are in line, when they're going to be seen, what's an estimated time. And like many of the time, we approached our vendor that we use for telemedicine. That wasn't a current feature. And they said, this is a great idea. Let us work on that. But we didn't have the time, you know, to wait for that. And so what we ended up doing was building a custom software tool using the data that we're getting for the telemedicine, taking advantage of, you know, common industry ways of texting people and notifying people, and creating an algorithm for wait times based on how we staff and which states we have providers on at that time, so that we can be completely transparent with patients about where they are in line, when they're going to be seen. And so I'd say, you know, going back to where your question is, I think the most important thing is always going to be the patient and the consumer experience. There are other stakeholders as well that we need to take into account, the providers, the payers, right, the administrators. But if we can start with that patient journey and just figure out how can we make it more whole and more, you know, appealing to them and more empathetic to what they're going through, that we'll always be doing the right thing, right? Like if we have to inconvenience ourselves as providers, or we inconvenience the, you know, the payers, or we inconvenience, you know, the administrative aspects of medicine, those aren't ideal. But as long as we are at least achieving what's right for the patient, then I know that we've got our North Star and we're headed in the right direction.
Right. I love that. It's that North Star. That's, you know, focus on the patient first. From your experience, what are the things that patients find most important as part of their patient journey and experience? Yeah.
The same things they find on the in-person. They want to be heard. They want to be understood. They want to know what is going on, and they want a plan. And for us, you know, one of the big things is they want to know how to reach us. You know, if they have questions, if there are follow-up things, you know, again, we work in an urgent care environment. So a lot of what we're dealing with is acute and episodic. And so, you know, sometimes patients have a one and done situation where they come to us and there's, you know, there's a treatment, there's a recommendation, there's a diagnosis. But many of the time, even if it's a fairly straightforward clinical situation, there are other things that come up. So I'll give you, you know, a small example. You know, we've had a lot of pink eye conjunctivitis over the past several months, and many of the treatments are drops or ointments that are given multiple times per day. And so with, you know, children back in school, inevitably what happens is, you know, can I give this before and after school? Do I need a note for the school to administer? And so it's all those small things. But you can imagine from the perspective of a parent, if they can't send their child to school and they have to keep their child out of school, that school note about a pink eye drop becomes the world to them, because then their work is impacted, their child is at home another day. Mm. And so, you know, it's sometimes some of those small things that we find so important. Patients are so tolerant with us about technology issues, about, you know, connectivity issues, about you know, waiting a little bit longer, but it's really those just being a empathetic human being, listening to them and being available to them, that they, those are the things that really matter to them from what we've found. And we actually did a couple of years ago on the in-person side, we actually did an interesting, you know, review of our data internally, because we surveyed patients about their satisfaction. And we found that patients' experience with waiting in our offices, this on the in-person side, that even if there was a huge gap on their waiting, like someone waited a small amount of time, someone waited a significant amount of time, that often that could be the experience of that patient and their perception and their satisfaction could be dramatically altered by who they saw. And we associated that with whether the person could be empathetic under the situation, understand their experience, both in terms of the waiting and the illness or whatever brought them there. And so there's a huge amount, you know, that we focus on that human interaction in order to, you know, provide what's most important to the patients.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. It's like patients will be tolerant with you on the technology stuff if you get the right person that Correct. Is empathetic and listen.
Yeah.
How do you communicate that to the providers to get them to understand that and get them to adapt those type of techniques? And how do you get them to do that?
Yeah. This may sound off topic, but I'll start with sort of a joke. I often say to my children, if they're complaining about something or their own skill set or how they're able to deal with something, I'll joke with them. I'll say, well, whether it's nurture or nature, either way, you can blame me, because whether it's your genetics or whether it's the way you've been raised, you know, you can take that out on me or my wife. Because either way, you know, at this age, they're, you know, we've been responsible for that. You know, on the provider side and on the, you know, healthcare personnel side, so much of it is nature. Some of it is nurture, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, certain people just innately have the ability to connect with other people. They're empathetic. And thankfully, in the world of medicine, particularly in the provider and the clinician world, so many people who have gone into medicine do that because that is their passion, that's their desire. Right. So, you know, we're very lucky, you know, speaking at least for the United States system, which I know the best, you know, those who are clinicians and providers, by and large, everyone I've ever interacted with, they're passionate, they're dedicated, they really want to help people. And so you're starting at a very high bar where you've got people, you know, that are self-selected for that. But then, you know, in addition to that, what we certainly do is we have onboarding, you know, processes where we go with people about how to make sure to display those things over a video, which is not easy and intuitive how to do those things. We have ongoing meetings with our virtual providers. We have regional virtual leaders who are responsible, their medical directors who are responsible for helping to convey this. And we watch our surveys very closely to make sure that those regions and individual providers are actually delivering this so that we can measure that impact, at least from the perception of the patient.
So it's interesting. You're using a lot of like the surveys and measurements and then providing feedback to the providers.
Yeah.
Are the providers receptive to that feedback?
By and large, yes. I mean, again, you know, the vast majority of, you know, not even thinking about our organization specifically, but clinicians and providers generally, again, they're in a profession because they want to help people. They're in a profession that they're looking to serve. And so if there is feedback and ways that they can do that better, now, of course, you know, some people take that, you know, that feedback, you know, right away and run with it. And some people need, you know, some training or some extra reminders. And there's always the outliers, you know, who don't fit. And, you know, maybe we don't retain those people as part of the organization. But by and large, you know, providers and healthcare personnel are very used to feedback. It's just sort of a core process of our training.
Right.
There is so much grading. There is so much, you know, feedback, both written and verbal as part of the process. And I think certainly as a society, we have also grown to be much more open about feedback over the last decade or so. And so I think there's just generally a higher level of acceptance in society of feedback and that concept. And so that only helps bolster, you know, what we have already.
Yeah. So you mentioned that patients are pretty tolerant when it comes to technology issues and whatever. What is your approach when it comes to technology? And what do you really look for when you are selecting technologies to use? And obviously, you want to create the ideal patient experience. What does that ideal patient experience look like from the technology perspective? What things do you look for and prioritize?
I actually don't look at the technology so much. I look more at the people and the company who are delivering the technology to make sure that they feel like they are the right partners. And that's because, you know, particularly in the world of telemedicine, there are so many platforms out there right now. And, you know, each one has its advantages and disadvantages. many of them are using the same backbone video technology anyways.
Right.
And what I'm really looking for is someone who will partner with us and understand our needs and be responsive when there's an emergency, be responsive when we identify a new workflow or a new need to help us adapt to that new workflow or that new need. Because to me, it's far more important who I'm working with than it is what the technology looks like right now. And so I would far rather choose a technology that's sort of limited in scope and maybe doesn't meet every workflow requirement, or even if it's not, you know, it's 99.9% stable as opposed to 100% stable, as long as I know that the team that's working on it is going to be a partner to us and have the same vision and have that same, you know, sort of patient-centric focus, so that when there's a significant patient issue, that they understand the priority of that and they will respond accordingly. So
no, that's very, very insightful.
I almost said, I almost don't look at the technology. I look more at, you know, at the people.
And how do you assess that? How do you determine if they're going to be a good fit or not for you?
Oh, you know, that one's really hard to quantify. I mean, it's certainly, it's like dating someone, right? You just know when it's a good fit and you know when it's not a good fit. I mean, there's certainly some, you know, some obvious criteria we can look at. I would say probably, from like an objective standpoint, one of the most useful things that I do is I will talk to references who are several years into use, if, you know, if available. If it's a brand new, you know, technology, it's not going to be relevant, but talking to references who are several years into using it, because they really have that perspective of, this is what it's going to be like when you first onboard, this is going to be your maintenance experience, and this is what it's going to be like when you have new things coming up. And so having those people who have been with them several years is really the way to get the, for me, the best perspective on where it's headed.
Mm-hmm. Have you made any mistakes along the way?
So many.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to even think. Are you looking for some examples?
Yeah, I mean, anything that, you know, it's, you know, smart people learn from their mistakes, wise people learn from other people's mistakes. And so you've been through a lot, you've done a lot. What are some like big mistakes that you've made in the past that you've changed yourself that you can help others learn to avoid in the future?
Yeah, we are certainly a growing organization. And so, you know, call us a medium to large size organization. You know, we've got about, you know, close to 2,000 employees at this point. When I started with the company 6 years ago, we were about 300. And so we've had massive growth in between. And so we have really a phenomenal group of leaders in so many different departments and so many different areas that I'd say the biggest mistake I've made along the way that's, you know, certainly becomes clear in hindsight is not involving that brain trust early enough from all those different areas. So as an example, you know, in early COVID, when we launched our telemedicine and rapidly expanded from just doing telemedicine in Alaska to sort of instantly doing it in the 15 states that were operating 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. So we took, you know, a handful of visits a day to thousands of visits a day in a very brief period of time, is thinking about kind of the workflows on the billing and the administrative side early enough could have saved us a lot of the headaches and the cleanup that we had to do after the fact. But again, there was so much focus on sort of go fast, launch now. So trying to figure out how to be both efficient with not letting a new initiative get dragged down by too many cooks in the kitchen, but at the same time, not having your blindfolders on and not taking advantage of your amazing colleagues and leaders who are with you along the way and want to help you be successful. I think that's like a really challenging balance to figure out, you know, how not to get stuck, but at the same time, how not to run too fast that you miss out on key important steps that you want to do along the way.
Yeah. You know, hindsight's 2020, especially in the time of COVID, because you're just like, we got to go fast and we got to get people on board. And, you know, looking back, it's just like, it would have been great to have some of the support staff involved and it would have saved a lot of time, but it wasn't necessarily the top of the mind then, but it wasn't that hard either to have done it. So yeah, that's very interesting. So really quick, tell us a little bit about your organization.
Yeah, so PM Pediatric Care originally started as PM Pediatric Urgent Care. And in 2005 was essentially founded by Jeff Shore and Steve Katz, who were college roommates. Jeff Shore, like myself, is a pediatric emergency medicine physician and then run a very successful emergency department. And Steve Katz had a business background and done management consulting, and they were roommates, and they said, wow, there's got to be a better way to take care of children for illnesses and injuries than having them wait for hours in emergency departments, right, high cost visits, you know, like a really complicated, expensive environment. There are so many things that could be done in a way that's, you know, cheaper, faster, a better experience for the patient. What if we open up a pediatric urgent care? And at the time, this was an incredibly novel concept back in 2005, because there were barely any urgent cares, let alone a specialized urgent care that does pediatrics and focuses on children. So the entire organization is pediatric focused, just like you would think of a children's hospital. You walk into our offices, they are designed, you know, in a very kid-friendly way. And we have different themes. We have like an animal theme in one office, a castle cool. theme in another office. We have all pediatric providers who all have pediatric training. And everything is done, again, sort of from that kid and that parent, you know, patient-focused way. And so, you know, this business got, you know, got going along the way between 2005 and call it 2017. And then we started to realize, okay, there's going to be a new frontier of telemedicine. And that's when, you know, when I joined in the end of 2016. And so we started exploring what is, you know, we're trying to almost like predict the next step. You know, where is this going to head, and how are we going to loop in telemedicine to what we do? What, you know, what portion of what we do is going to be on telemedicine? What's going to be in the mm-hmm. office? Which things can we handle at home? And so we spent a couple of years, you know, till 2019, figuring out kind of where we wanted to head. And then, like I mentioned, we, you know, we launched our urgent care telemedicine in Alaska, and then rapidly, you know, took it everywhere else. And, you know, and then along the way, the vision and the mission statement of the company since 2005 had always been to radically change healthcare. It wasn't about pediatric urgent care. It was like, how do we do all of this better with, you know, with a focus certainly on pediatrics. And so, you know, where we're headed, you know, in the future is really, how do we become the best experience and quality for pediatric outside of the hospital care? And that encompasses so many different things. Again, we've done urgent care, we're adding on behavioral health, we're starting to work with schools, we're doing it both, you know, on all these initiatives, we're doing them both in the home and on in the office. And so that's really the big picture goal is, you know, how do we deliver the absolute best healthcare experience for everyone involved, you know, in a way that's, you know, looking towards the future and figuring out what are the myriad of different services that, you know, that we can provide. We're starting to do, together with our behavioral health, we're doing parent coaching. So not just visits with therapists, but also visits with coaches who can help people with things like sleep training children, general parenting advice. I mean, there's so many needs out there, and there's so many opportunities for us to be able to give back in those ways and connect with people with where they, you know, with where they need.
Yeah. And that's a great segue. So tell me, what is your vision for the future of healthcare?
You know, my vision for the future of healthcare is that healthcare become technology and consumer oriented in the way that so many other sectors have already become. And for good reason, you know, healthcare has a lot of other safety and quality and regulation things, but, you know, healthcare in general has been held back or slower than other areas, right? We've had mobile banking and check deposits at home, you know, for a decade or two now. And that's so easy to do banking at home. Many of us probably never walk into a physical bank for almost anything these days, right? And so the question is, how do we make healthcare so consumer and technology enabled that it becomes similar to our experience of shopping online, whether that be, you know, having things delivered to our homes, or whether it's even just groceries brought within an hour. You know, that type of, you know, positive association that we have with those experiences and with those technology, I hope that we can have in healthcare. If you look, you know, one of the things that we focus on a lot in our surveys is what's called a net promoter score. And it's a way to evaluate, you know, how likely your patients, consumers are to recommend you to others. And, you know, the best technology companies in the world are sitting in like in the 80s. And we're very proud of the fact that we are also sitting, you know, in the 80s, and it's on a zero to, it's actually on a minus 100 to a positive 100 scale. Yeah. But if you look in healthcare across the board, while we're in the 80s and we're so proud of that, the vast majority of healthcare on the, you know, hospital or outpatient side is like 50s, 60s, 20s. And some of the payers are on the negative side. There's so much frustration on that consumer patient side that I hope healthcare will evolve to being more like those other areas are in our life, where those net promoter scores are much higher, which translates into a, you know, just a better experience.
Which circles back to, you know, looking at the patient experience and the patient workflow and building around that, creating that ideal experience. Have you seen any interesting insights from your time leading telemedicine and since you've been doing this?
Yeah, certainly. And one of the areas that I think has the most potential to provide additional insights is really research. We've done a little bit of research on telemedicine. We've looked at 30,000 visits that we did early in COVID and were able to characterize kind of what patients were coming in for, what treatments were done. We were, as an aside, we were very proud of the fact that while telemedicine has often gotten a bad reputation for quality, that if you look at our prescribing patterns, we are, you know, rarely prescribing antibiotics, and when they're done, they're for appropriate diagnoses that can be diagnosed over telemedicine, cellulitis, skin infections, impetigo, another skin issue. And so we were really happy about that, but we found there's so little in the area of telemedicine looking at large-scale studies about the delivery of healthcare over telemedicine, and that's understandable because it's a relatively new mechanism to deliver healthcare. That I'm very excited about all the research coming out now and going forward to help us better understand, you know, what can be safely done over telemedicine. Where can telemedicine potentially be even better than other areas of telemedicine? I'll share an anecdote. One of the things that we've done recently is, we've had offices that are incredibly busy. As I mentioned, there are, you know, huge number of respiratory illnesses going around now. And we've been able to have some of the patients in the office be provided an opportunity to say, you're welcome to wait and see a provider in the office. But if you're interested, we actually have providers who are located elsewhere, whether at home or another office, who can see you on video. And we're happy to take care of you that way. Is that something you'd be willing to do? So they walked into the office expecting an in-person experience, but then we're provided the opportunity to do telemedicine. And one of the parents reflected after doing this that, wow, this was amazing, because you know what happened? Even though I'm in a healthcare facility, because the door was closed and you were at home, I saw you without your mask and I was able to take off my mask, and we had an interaction in healthcare without masks. And that was so refreshing and something that hasn't been done in so long that they just really appreciated having that interaction. So there are these unanticipated, you know, benefits to telemedicine, and trying to be able to quantify those and figure out, you know, where there are potential positive or negative, you know, surprises from telemedicine. I think we're just really early in that journey. And so I think there's a lot more research that can be done to help elicit those things.
And like, what type of things do you expect to find, and what questions are you going to be asking of the data?
To me, there's sort of two areas that I'm most interested in. One is like what I would call almost like an implementation science. You know, what are the best ways to deliver telemedicine and virtual care to patients, and both in terms of the technology, but then also just in terms of looking at how do we examine patients remotely? You know, there are some studies that I've been reading that I'm very excited about that really give detailed instruction to providers and patients about how to conduct different maneuvers that we would typically do in the office, potentially ourselves on a patient, but that a parent can do on a patient. So, as an example, you know, when I have a child in the home where they have abdominal pain, where their belly is hurting, one of the things that I would typically do in the office is we would palpate the abdomen, and there's, you know, four quadrants of the abdomen. There are different things that we're feeling for. I'll actually have the child lie down at home on a couch or on the floor and have the parent do that. And these are sort of the small things that we've learned along the way, but there are numerous examples of this where we just need to spread that sort of implementation science about how to do things in the home environment. I'd say that's one. And then the other areas is really looking at the quality of medicine, figuring out, almost more important than measuring what we're doing, is trying to figure out what we need to measure. I think that's been one of the biggest challenges, is, you know, in healthcare in general, but specifically trying to isolate in virtual or telemedicine type care, what are the quality metrics that are really important? So first figuring out what those are and then measuring those, because again, there are fantastic ways to deliver high quality care on telemedicine. And of course, there are, you know, ways that we don't want to deliver that care, but we need to be able to figure out kind of what that is and measure it, and then, you know, be able to spread and share those things with others.
So you're looking at data already. I assume that's just system data. Are you proactively putting out surveys and assessments to get at some of this information?
Yeah. Again, we've done some research that we've published. It's freely available. And then we do, you know, a huge amount of QI and internal work to look at, you know, how we're delivering care. I'd say we are sort of in a unique position where we have so much data and so much available that we are limited by how much bandwidth we have to actually produce that research and share that. So I wish we had the ability to share it you know, quicker and in a larger way, but we're, you know, we're slowly churning through it as much as we can.
I think that's great. So Dr. Rusks, thank you so much for your time today. Very insightful, very fun conversation. And I know this will be useful to many people.
You're very welcome and happy to be here.